Natural Resources together. We're going to deal with House Bill 2200 first this morning. And we are going to have Judith review the issues that are in front of us, and then we're going to have dueling attorneys, I think, is what we're going to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2200 comes to us from the Department of Forestry. It did pass the House with a 54-0 vote. It exempts forest protective associations, rangeland protection systems, and public bodies from liability for certain fire protection actions. It allows liability for willful misconduct or gross negligence and establishes liability limitations. It would indeed declare an emergency effective on passage. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments. At the last minute meeting, we received the Dash 1 amendments. You have also a hand-engrossed version of those, and if for whatever reason you don't have those in your files, we do have extra copies here, as well as a memo from Legislative Council bringing up some possible constitutionality questions regarding those liability limitations. I have added, for your easy reference, the ORS 30.270, which that's the amount of the liability limitation we're talking about in this measure. The Dash 1 amendments do define every reasonable effort to mean the use of the reasonably available personnel and equipment under the supervision and control of an owner or operator, which are needed and effective to fight the fire in the judgment of the forester, and which can be brought to bear on the fire in a timely fashion. We do have a no revenue and no fiscal impact both on the original measure and the Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. I thought I understood everything related to this bill. The Dash 1 amendment definition of every reasonable effort and all that stuff. And since it came to us 54-0, it ought to be slam dunk. But the constitutional question underlying the bill is now before us, and Brendan is here, and Ian, right, from the Department of Justice is here, and they're going to present us with some interesting information, so come on up, and I don't care who goes first. I mean,
they don't have their banjos. How are they going to duel?
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. I am interested in how this question emerged, and I guess it emerged with Legislative Council, right? So why don't you point out, I guess this didn't get caught on the House side, even though it went through the House process. Can you explain that?
Good morning, members of the committee, Senator Shields, Brendan McCarthy from Legislative Council, for the record. That's correct. It didn't get caught on the House side. When I originally drafted the legislation, I wrote a memo to the department suggesting that there may be some constitutional issues with the bill, and for some reason that didn't get translated over into the House sides. This discussion didn't happen there. With everything else going on, it escaped my notice when it was heard, and so when I saw it on the Senate side, I thought, well, it's time to at least mention the fact that I have some worries. And it's a fairly complicated situation, to say the least, and it's not really my area of expertise dealing with the Oregon Tort Claims Act. But I will give a thumbnail sketch and hope that Ian interrupts if I stray from the path. Historically, prior to the creation of this country, from the Crown on down, generally, the Crown was not able to be sued. We'll start with that presumption. That sovereign immunity did not extend to officers and agents of the state. In the 60s, I think, in this state, we passed the Oregon Tort Claims Act, allowing the state to be sued. Eventually, we put some limits on it, and those limits extended to the agents and officers of the state. Several years ago in the Lakin decision, the Supreme Court of Oregon brought into question the limiting of capping of non-economic damages in certain cases, and said basically that such a cap may interfere with the right to trial by jury under Article 1, Section 17 of the Constitution. That was essentially the subject of my memorandum to the department, saying in this bill looks like we're capping liability, and there is this Lakin decision, and although I'm not an expert, I feel as though we may have a constitutional issue here. Additionally, several years later, and just I guess it was actually this year, the Oregon Supreme Court opined on the question of remedies available to people under the Constitution, remedies available, and the impact of Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. And the question is whether, if by legislation we restrict a remedy that was available to someone at the time of statehood under common law, whether that is a constitutional exercise of the legislature, whether we can do that. And we can restrict remedies that were available as long as we provide another constitutionally adequate remedy. This bill seems to restrict the remedy in that it caps the liability completely and makes certain individuals acting for rangeland protective associations and even the department, cities, municipalities, in fighting fires, exempt from liability. So, Ian has brought up the issue, and it's a good issue, as to whether firefighters themselves, acting as agents of the state, were exempt from liability under common law. And I think it is somewhat of an open question. There are some cases which would say that certainly the municipalities themselves are not liable for the actions of their firefighters. Fighting fires is a good thing. We want to encourage the public policy of fighting fires. If a firefighter uses too much water in putting out a fire and soaks some neighbor's house, we're going to say, as a public policy, you know, that's okay because we're putting out this fire. We're not going to make this firefighter liable for those damages. And we're certainly not going to make the municipality liable for those damages. And at the moment, I haven't completely squared or found case law clearly exempting the firefighter, him or herself, from liability, and that's what this bill does. Given what I've read in the past few days, I would say that I am not staunchly opposed to this bill on constitutional grounds any longer. And I will let Ian speak to see and cover the same ground if I left anything out.
Thank you. Senator Shields, members of the committee, Ian Whitlock with the Department of Justice, General Counsel Division assigned to the Department of Forestry. I think Brendan accurately reviewed the potential concerns on two constitutional bases. One, the jury clause, the guarantee to jury trial, which is implicated in some of the damage cap cases. And the second, the remedies clause. I think the remedies clause is really the more important one for the purposes of this bill. I think Brendan correctly identifies this as a concern for the committee's attention, but I don't believe that that the concern need be need put an end to this dialogue. I don't believe that the constitutionality of the bill is clear by unconstitutionality is clear by any means. And in fact, I think it's a much safer bet that the bill is constitutional. And the reason is fairly simple. Under the remedies clause cases, the Smothers decision of 2001 and its progeny in the last year and a half, 2 years. the question that we're confronted with in an instance where one seems to be eliminating a ground of liability is, was a remedy available at the time the Constitution was adopted in 1857? In shorthand, if it was, then there's a significant problem with eliminating it. You can run afoul of the Remedies Clause if you make that remedy disappear and don't provide any sort of a substitute. In looking at the cases, it appears relatively clear to me that there was not a cause of action in ordinary negligence against either the state or municipalities or firefighters in 1857 for ordinary negligence. And so there isn't a difficulty with this bill, because the bill doesn't eliminate liability altogether. What it does is eliminate liability for ordinary negligence. Liability remains for gross negligence or willful misconduct. Now, I think what would be helpful to Brendan and I in advising the committee would be to have a case that's directly on point that says precisely, well, you couldn't sue firefighters or firefighting agencies in 1857. We haven't found that case. We found cases which suggest that perhaps the reason we don't find that case is everybody assumed that was true.
Assumed what was true?
Assumed that you could not sue in ordinary negligence. That the immunity of the state firefighting agencies, and that immunity is clear, that immunity also extended to individual firefighters as well. There are cases which dance around the issue somewhat. Let me read to you a decision from Wagner versus the City of Portland. It's been uniformly held that a city is not liable for the negligent acts of a fireman in the performance of his duty. Firemen are public officers and are not the agents of the city in its corporate or proprietary capacity. Their duty is governmental, and they represent the public as an arm of the state for whose acts municipalities are not liable. So that much is pretty clear, the status of the state itself.
What was the date on that, Mr. Chair?
The date of the Wagner decision,
I believe it's 1902.
1902, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering just what kind of an organization of firefighters we had in 1857.
Well, that's a very good question. We now have in existence firefighting entities which didn't exist at all at the critical time, and so you look by analogy to other types of governmental entities, and as Mr. McCarthy explained, the principle of sovereign immunity would have protected a governmental entity almost regardless of what exactly its business was, firefighting, police protection, or whatever service it was providing, until the Tort Claims Act came along and modified the right of citizens to make claims against the state subject to the limits of the Tort Claims Act.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Corcoran.
So I would wonder if, I guess my feeling about this particular piece of legislation is we ought to move it forward and, you know, allow some future challenge to happen. And I guess my question to you folks is, does providing this legislation make any difference? Would it make any difference to the courts in making a decision about some future case? I'm thinking of, you know, urban-rural interface fire mm-hmm. situation, and, you know, you can see where somebody could classically make a complaint of negligence, and because there's people criticizing the decisions, the tactical decisions that were made during the fire season last year, mm-hmm. and so, you know, that could create a wave of people saying, you know, you moved our firefighting troops out to Colorado and other places, we should have had them home, house burned down, I'm going to sue the state. Would this legislation give us any greater protection going forward as the courts would decide something like this?
I believe it would have some effect. There's an argument, Chair Shields, Senator Corcoran, that really all this statute does is codify what the existing common law is. namely that you can't bring ordinary negligence claims against folks for this kind of activity. There are certainly federal cases involving the U.S. Forest Service in which it's been held that you cannot challenge the Forest Service for discretionary acts involving, for example, allocation of resources. You sent too many firefighters to fire A. If you'd held some back, you would have been able to fight fire B. Fire B burned down my house. Well, those are discretionary acts of the government which can't be challenged, and I believe that would apply to state entities as well. I think you could argue that the bill doesn't really add anything to the way the common law would play out at all, but it does certainly make it clearer, and so it would have that advantage.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Shields, Senator Corcoran, just to add on to that comment, public officials are already, and their actions are already exempt from ordinary negligence claims where it is a discretionary act. So in on the state level as well, I think the case law is fairly clear, very clear to me that where a public official is making a determination as to perhaps which fire to fight first and how to allocate resources and those types of policy, larger policy decisions, they are not subject to claims. But what we're talking about here is an individual firefighter performing some negligent act, running through the stop sign on the way to the fire, that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Parker.
Well, then I would ask the advice of both of you then, since I'm not finding the notion of discretionary behavior in the bill, would it make sense to add that piece, or do you think the bill as it stands is fine to move forward? And I'd ask a question to both of you. Sorry, maybe I missed it. The amendment might have it in there.
No, I don't believe so.
Chair Shields, Senator Corcoran, I think what the bill is doing is actually providing a greater exemption for ordinary negligence liabilities than would just the discretionary element. I think adding the discretionary element would not particularly add any clarity or greater protection to firefighters from being sued.
Okay, thank you.
I believe that's correct. I think that the thrust of the cases which have come most closely to describing the immunity which I believe existed for firefighters at common law don't tie it so much to discretionary actions. They tie it to a state policy which basically says we want firefighters to go all out to do their job, just as we want policemen to go all out to do their job, and we don't want to tie them down with the possibility of being sued for negligence as long as what they're doing falls within the standards of conduct for firefighters doing their job. That excludes gross negligence, willful misconduct, which is excluded by the statute.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Beyer and I have decided that this bill is actually moot because we couldn't be sued anyway because we don't have any money, thanks to the Republicans. I just wanted to point that out.
I don't think I agreed with that last part of that.
Yeah, right. I'm sure you didn't. My interest here is that it looks like the House passed a bill 54-0 that was clear, and we're going to send it on, it looks like, noting that it's a little cloudy. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Shields, I guess I get paid to worry for you, and that's what I'm doing here. Suffice to say that I don't think it's completely clear, but I'm not going to try and step in the way of passing this bill. I think it's a policy decision that the legislature needs to make. If you decide that we should go forward and risk the possibility of some later suit claiming that are trying to cap the liability, exempt firefighters from liability was unconstitutional, then I will admit the possibility is remote, but it, you know.
Right.
And Mr. Whitlock thinks it's less remote or more remote than I do. So,
okay.
We have a difference of opinion, and as someone said to me the other day, you get 11 lawyers in a room and you get 14 different opinions. So
right.
That's where we are.
Well, Brendan's looking for a pay raise, Mr.
I
He's worrying.
I appreciate the fact that this is on the record, because now we can say that we noticed kind of the oversight potentially as it came out of the House. With that, I'm going to ask if Charlie Stone or Mike Ditzel have anything they want to add to this debate before we go to a work session.
You forgot to ask if they want to talk or if they want the bill.
Yeah, do you guys want to talk or do you want the bill is the question.
Charlie Stone for the Department of Forestry. I just wanted to offer some written testimony for the record to put on record what I said on February 17th and ask that you do include the Dash 1 amendments and pass the
okay.
bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mike Dykstra with the Oregon Forest Industries Council was prepared to offer written testimony as well on the Every Reasonable Effort Dash 1 amendments, which were not included when it was on the House side.
Okay. So you both have interest in the Every Reasonable Effort thing. You're not weighing in on this cloudy versus clear question.
That was great.
Thank you.
Relative to constitutionality. Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill or House Bill 2200 and open a work session on House Bill 2200.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2200.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2200. Are there any objections? Discussion first. Any objections to the Dash 1 amendments? They are therefore added.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2200 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2200 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of that? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fischer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. So House Bill 2200 is passed to the floor, and Senator Beyer has volunteered to carry it. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2200 and open a hearing on House Bill 2033. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House Bill 2033A comes to us at the request of the Oregon Albacore Commission. It passed the House with the 57.
Oregon Albacore Commission?
Yes, sir.
We knew that was going to happen.
How many FTEs in that particular agency? Oh.
Moving along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This measure is coming to us from the House with a 57-0 vote.
My question is, did all 57 that voted for the bill know what the heck an albacore was? I mean, you know. Never mind.
We'll hope so, Mr. Chair.
Isn't that the capital of New Mexico? No, I'm sorry.
Close enough.
The measure would indeed permit the State Fish and Wildlife Director to suspend, deny renewal of, or refuse to issue licenses for non-payment of fees owed. We do have a no revenue and no fiscal impact received on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got Nick Furman wanting to testify. Thank you for coming, Nick.
Thank you. I can see this is going to be a interesting conversation. I'm not going to waste your time trying to explain what the Albacore Commission is per se, but hopefully when I'm done in a few minutes, the committee will be somewhat enlightened. For the record, my name is Nick Furman. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Albacore Commission, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission. I want to begin today by thanking Representative Al Brown, along with Senator Messerly and Representative Krieger, for their willingness to tackle this issue on our behalf, as well as the staff of both ODF&W and ODA, who put their heads together to come up with what we think is a solution to our problem. In February of 2002, Representative Brown listened as members of the Albacore Commission expressed their frustration at the inability to collect assessments from a coastal fish buyer that owed the commission in excess of $30,000. These are funds that are withheld from the fishermen's settlement to be passed along to the Commodity Commission to conduct programs on behalf of the industry. Over a period of two short albacore seasons, this buyer had accumulated a debt to the commission that totaled roughly three-fourths of the OAC's annual budget. I might add that the company also owed and still owes the Dungeness Crab Commission $25,000, fisherman dollars, that we acknowledge will probably never be collected. ORS 576335 requires that first receivers collect these assessments and pass them along to the respective commodity commissions on a monthly basis. While most of the fish buyers along the coast do an excellent job of working with the commissions to collect these funds, there are a few that habitually choose to ignore the law and willfully spurn attempts to retrieve the money that is withheld. They continue to deduct the required assessment from the fisherman's paycheck with no intent of passing it along to the commission. For a lack of a better description, they are stealing the money. The fisherman assumes that the assessment has been paid when, in fact, the buyer simply pockets the money as extra profit. Not only does this cause extreme financial hardship on small commissions like the Albacore Commission, but when you think about it, it also creates an unfair disadvantage for competing companies that don't have this free money to add to the bottom line. And I'll divert from my prepared testimony by just saying, for the record, that the Albacore Commission and the Dungeness Crab Commission are proud to say that we operate under the Oregon Department of Agriculture's Commodity Commission program and are 100% industry funded. So there is no money that comes from the state budget or tax dollars to fund these two organizations. ODA and state guidelines require that the commissions turn over delinquent assessment accounts to the Oregon Department of Revenue for collections. This process has been relatively ineffective to date. These few companies managed to evade all attempts to be brought into compliance while continuing to purchase product and increase their debt. It's been our experience that the same companies that owe us money are also behind in their poundage taxes to the state through the Department of Fish and Wildlife as well. We are convinced that the only way to get some of these individuals to play by the rules is to threaten their very ability to legally buy and sell fish in the state of Oregon. We are certain that if they know they will not be able to renew their licenses unless their accounts are settled, we will achieve 100% compliance in short order. HB 2033 provides just that sort of solution. By requiring that all commodity commission fees are paid before ODF&W issues and or renews licenses, those whose intent is to defraud commercial fishermen by pocketing those collected assessments will be forced to comply or cease operations. It's just that simple. Although they will still be able to operate fraudulently for a season, the habitual offenders at the root of this problem will no longer be able to amass large debts year after year that they have no intention of paying. Commercial fishermen are entitled to know that the money that is withheld from their paycheck each delivery to support the programs they have authorized on behalf of their commodity commissions to conduct on their behalf is in fact getting to that commission. We are convinced that this legislation will ensure just that. And I just have one brief example, and I'll close with this. Back in December, we had a company that we had repeatedly made attempts to collect a fairly significant amount of money. And just on the off chance that they might respond to additional stimulation, the office manager for the Crab and Albacore Commission, in sending out the monthly statement, I asked if I could write a brief note on that. And I said, Frank, sure would like to get this cleaned up, period. Soon, comma, anyone who owes ODF&W or Commodity Commission's money for fish taxes or assessments will not be able to renew their fish buyer's license. We hate to see that happen to anyone. Nick. As he read this in December, after spurning us for multiple years, he mixed up, obviously, the period and the comma, and he read it as anyone who owes ODF&W will not be able to pay their fish taxes. He contacted us immediately after receiving this and said, how much do I owe? Well, we'd heard that 100 times. He also called about 2 weeks later and said, are you going to be open the last week of December? Are you going to, is anybody going to be in the office over the holidays? We said, yes. Lo and behold, on 12/31, We received payment in full for $2,341 from this buyer for the very reason that he interpreted that his ability to get a fish buyer's license on January 1 from ODF&W was going to be in jeopardy if he didn't pay this bill. We've written off thousands of dollars from this company in the past. This, just the idea, the notion that this legislation was going to pass brought him into compliance. And so we feel that that when it's officially law, that we will not be in this situation again. And not only will the Commodity Commission programs benefit from this, but also the state will via monies collected and owed to the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
You just said that you've written off thousands of dollars from this guy before. Mm-hmm. That he hasn't paid, and you mentioned, is it the same company or a different company where you've given up on $25,000?
Actually, a net total of $60,000 to that company.
That's a different company?
That's a different company.
So, over the years, you've lost a lot of money, and you said it's a large part of your commission's operational expenses. Has this crippled your ability to do your job?
In the case of I need to explain that in the case of the Albacore Commission, that's the state's newest commodity commission. It's only been in existence for 3 years.
Okay.
And it has a very small budget, a limited budget. And so $25,000 out of a budget that has grown to approximately $40,000 a year for a small commodity commission is, as you can see, quite significant. That was over a two-year period. The Dungeness Crab Commission has been in existence since 1977. Our budget is considerably larger, in a neighborhood of $250,000 to $350,000 per year. And even though we lose, in this case, it was a $30,000 hit there, and we don't consider that to be small in proportion to our budget, but it doesn't affect our ability to do our job. The big issue here is that the money has been collected from the fishermen. It's been deducted from their paychecks. They assume that that is being passed on to the Commodity Commission. In the case of these few companies, they're simply not complying with the law and passing it on.
I'm ready to move the bill, although I'm interested. It just offends me that these guys can walk off with somebody else's money and there's apparently nothing that can be done at this point.
It is very offensive, and it's been very difficult over the last 12 years to see companies just repeatedly. And I do want to point out and mention that it's the proverbial one bad apple spoils the whole bunch, because 99% of the companies on the coast are in compliance and we have very good relationships with. But it's been, up to this point, it's been very, very difficult to get to retrieve those funds if their intent is to not pay them.
Okay. Any other questions other than mine? Well, thank you for coming. Kay Brown has also signed up to testify, so I'm going to give her a few minutes here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kay Brown with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I just want to let you know that we support House Bill 2033. It provides an enforcement tool for both the State Fish Commodity Commissions and also the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in order to assure collection of statutory fees. Mr. Furman did a fine job of explaining the issue for them, so I'll just move into how it impacts us. We have had for a number of years the ability to refuse to issue a license if someone doesn't pay the fees that they owe us in the fish dealers. They pay an ad valorem tax or tax on the value of the fish that they purchase from commercial fishermen. But there is also additional fees that they also owe us in terms of bycatch or incidental catch that's taken and purchased by the fish dealer and then owed to the department. And those fees we have not been able to collect. In addition, when they owe us a large amount of money, the only ability we've had is to refuse to issue their license at the end of the year. Sometimes that amounts to a large debt that they owe us throughout the year if it starts building in January and works towards the end of the year. And so by the time we get to the end of the year and it's time to renew their license, they may have already entered bankruptcy or some other situation where we're unable to collect that debt. So this bill actually adds some additional enforcement tools for us as well in order to collect debts that are owed to the department. And for that reason, we support the bill.
Okay. Other questions? I I'm still mystified by all of this. You'd think that the 99 guys that are doing it honestly and fairly would have a conversation with the one guy that's maybe not performing good civic duty.
We need to call Terry Thompson and see if conversation is the appropriate term.
I'm being polite this morning.
Eating fish, I think, is what they usually call it.
Somebody was suggesting keel hauling is an appropriate remedy here.
Don't be saying all that in front of this nice lady, though, Senator. That's not nice. No.
Any other questions? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2033A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2033 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? If not, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. House Bill 2033 is passed. Is there somebody would like to carry this little?
Carry that moldy fish.
I'll carry it.
Tony will carry the fish bucket this time. And with that, the agenda is complete and we're adjourned.